This podcast is supported by Australian Ethical. Australian Ethical grow your retirement savings without sacrificing integrity for performance, so you can build a better future for yourself and our world. Because when your super prospers, we all thrive. Please read the FSG, PDS and TMD on the website to consider if the product is right for you and the ethical guide to understand how they invest. Issued by Australian Ethical Superannuation Proprietary Limited, AFSL 526055.
Pyotr Sauer, you're a Russian affairs reporter for The Guardian. Where do things stand right now in Kyiv and Moscow?
Well, the mood is very different in both cities. Ukraine has had a very tough week in general. Last week, over 24 civilians were killed in another strike in western Ukraine. There have been power shortages. While Moscow is feeling confident, they're advancing on the battlefield. But I think the main development in both cities has been the talk of diplomacy. We've heard about three different peace plans that have come about in the last week. And I think everyone, civilians and officials, are looking closely at how they develop.
Pyotr, how did the current version of this plan come about and who was behind it?
Well, the most recent one came about over the weekend. It's actually a rework of the original 28-point peace plan. This one was rehashed by Ukrainian and American officials in Geneva.
America's top diplomat, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, has just arrived in Geneva as delegations from Ukraine and the United States, as well as European security chiefs, meet to discuss President Trump's 28-point plan to end the Russia-Ukraine war.
They had a flurry of talks. The main aim of this peace plan was to make the original 28-point peace plan more acceptable for Kyiv, because the original one was totally unacceptable for Ukraine. And that came, you know, straight out of Moscow together with the American officials and had some conditions that included a cap on Ukrainian military.
Agreeing to the Russian request that they have troops capped at 600,000 for the Ukrainians. And a significant
it would ask for Ukraine to give up land at eastern Ukraine that it currently holds, for which Ukraine has bled and suffered thousands and thousands of lives. It also included terms that would limit Ukraine from having Western military weapons and Western troops. Another term was some of the frozen Russian assets would actually be given back to Russia. It also demands a full amnesty for all war crimes, which would mean that all the atrocities Russian soldiers committed would be forgiven.
It couldn't be pursued in international
courts. Putin would not anymore be international wanted by The Hague, as he currently is, for war crimes and also for the kidnapping of the many Ukrainian children that were sent to Russia. So this is sort of a list that very much resembles Russia's original demands and were very tough on Ukraine. We know that Ukraine diplomats worked hard in Geneva to change that, and the new deal seems to take away some of those things. But it's very important. You know, this peace deal says that the three presidents, Trump, Zelensky, and Putin, would have to work out the most sensitive issues later on.
Right. Okay.
Which leaves a lot of room for interpretation. Russia has already said that they would reject whatever was written in Geneva.
Out of principle.
Out of principle, and because it's not their plan. Their plan was the original 28 points. And Russia has been clear that they want all of Donbas, Ukraine's mineral-rich eastern Ukrainian territories. They've been clear that they want written guarantees from the West that Ukraine would never join NATO. And they demand that Ukraine has no Western weapons or military on its ground.
And in terms of what Ukraine wants the most out of any prospective peace deal, like, what would their demands have been?
Well, you know, I think Zelensky always said that it has to be a just and dignified peace. You know, from the start, Ukraine said they don't want to lose more territory than they've currently already lost. So they would like to freeze the lines along the current battlefield. You know, they also asked for reconstruction of their country. So to use the 200 billion euros that are currently frozen by the EU, to use that money for a reconstruction of Ukraine,
right,
rather than what the original plan said, that some of the money would go to Ukraine and the other half would go to Russia together with the US,
right,
which is sort of a ridiculous prospect because this is money frozen in the EU and the Europeans would have to agree to that, which they said they wouldn't. But I think most importantly is for Ukraine that if they aren't allowed to join NATO, they still get some sort of guarantee that Russia does not invade. Whether these are sort of a similar NATO construct where countries come to their defense if Russia invades again, or ideally for Ukraine, Western boots on the ground.
Pyotr, as we speak on Tuesday afternoon, What shape are the negotiations in?
So this morning, Russian, Ukrainian and American officials flew to Abu Dhabi to discuss sort of this latest proposal, the rehashed plan that has been made into 19 points. American officials say that Ukraine has accepted a peace proposal during their talks in Abu Dhabi.
Learning from a U.S. official that Ukraine has agreed to a peace proposal to end the war with Russia, saying that only, quote, minor details are outstanding now. The word from Ukraine's President Zelensky is much work still lies ahead.
Russian officials are also at the talks, and there's no news yet whether Russia is accepting any kind of peace proposal.
And U.S. media outlets are reporting that Ukraine has accepted a deal, according to an unnamed U.S. official. How much do you think this is actually a briefing to apply pressure to Ukraine?
I think it's important to stress that the U.S. official said that they've agreed, but some minor issues are still to be ironed out. These minor issues might actually be quite major. They likely cover Ukraine's security guarantees, and they likely cover territory exchange or what sort of territory Ukraine will lose. But I do think it's a way for the U.S. to pressure Ukraine to, you know, to get them over the line. And they hope that once they have Ukraine over the line, they will get Russia over the line.
So when it comes to the detail of what Trump originally proposed, which a week ago was this 28-point plan for peace, now down to 19 points, what do we know about how it was drafted and how it emerged?
Yeah, the inception of this plan is fascinating. It was first leaked to Axios, the American news outlet, early last week. And now we're starting to learn more and more about how this plan was developed. It wasn't developed by traditional diplomats from either side. It was actually developed by Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and his old business partner, Steve Witkoff, together with Russia's special envoy, Kirill Dmitriev. All three men have very, very little experience in diplomacy, but they see themselves as deal makers. The plan started to develop around a month ago, mostly developed in Florida.
Today, White House Special Envoy Steve Witkoff set to meet with his Russian counterpart in Miami as President Trump's push to end the war in Ukraine intensified.
Dmitriev flew to Florida to meet with Kushner and Witkoff. And I think it says a lot about the Trump administration, because, you know, Trump always presents himself sort of as an anti-establishment deal maker. He doesn't care about traditional ways of doing diplomacy.
How effective is that strategy outside of the usual channels of diplomacy?
Well, yet to see. I think it's much easier to say that you're making a deal, but if you're not doing the actual diplomatic work behind it, I think it might prove to be very short-lived. The language of this deal was, I think, was striking, was written in a very transactional format. The language we usually see in peace deals was lacking. Often was unclear how certain things would be monitored, how they would be implemented. I think people in Russia also quickly said that Putin would not accept this paper, even though it was very favorable for Russia and they had a lot of input from Kirill Dmitriev, the Russian envoy. It still left a lot of room for interpretation. So I think that's interesting that even though you know, a lot of Ukrainians and Europeans right away said that this is a Russian plan, Putin himself was very careful in assessing it on Friday. He said that it is a good base work as a plan. But, you know, I have my issues with it.
I mean, people were saying it was a Russian plan to the point where there were rumors flying that it was written by Russians in Russia and then just sort of put through Google Translate. I mean, what did you make of that?
I thought it was funny, but I Google translated back into Russian. And yeah, I'm a native Russian speaker, and it looked silly in Russian as well, and it looked very clunky in Russian as well.
Right.
I think the main point, the main takeaway, really is that it's just a plan not written by professionals, but by people who are used to, you know, making property deals and business deals.
And how unusual is it? I mean, yes, we've talked about the fact that it's been drafted outside of the usual channels of diplomacy, but the fact that it is so, or was so, aligned with Russian interests, given that the U.S. is supposed to be such a major ally for Ukraine.
It is unusual, and I think one of the main reasons for it is that Steve Witkoff was one of the architects of this peace plan. Steve Witkoff has visited Putin on several occasions.
How are you, Mr. President?
Fine, just fine, thank you.
Very good.
He has spoken very favorably of Putin. He was on a podcast with Tucker Carlson.
Putin's got a huge respect for the president.
Carlson asked Witkoff if he liked Putin, and he said,
"I don't regard Putin as a bad guy."
Yeah, you know, I think the Russians have done a very good job at massaging Witkoff's ego. From the very start, they identified Witkoff as a man they could work with, because the Russians knew there are other factions in the White House that are traditionally more opposed to the Kremlin. If we think about Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and he seems to have been left out of negotiations. Rubio traditionally is sort of more part of the hawkish camp is more realistic as well about what Russia wants. So I think the Russians really targeted Witkoff, and I think now we're seeing the fruits of that.
And in terms of, well, you said that Putin announced that it was perhaps a good base, but not something he would necessarily agree to. But how did Ukraine respond to that first deal?
I think the general population, activists and soldiers, they were outraged. They said that this is a de facto capitulation. We will lose our sovereignty.
And everything they fought for.
And everything they fought for, and the hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians who died, soldiers and civilians, of course. But Ukrainian official had to be way more careful because they know they're operating with Trump. We've seen in the past, of course, that Trump has been very emotional and angry in his the way he is.
He posted this where he lashed Ukraine's leadership, saying Ukraine's leadership has expressed zero gratitude for our efforts and
over Ukraine's refusal to accept Russia's demands. We've seen Zelensky going through the motion of saying how grateful he is for Trump's work. I think everyone's afraid of a repeat at the White House where Trump shouted at Zelensky and humiliated him. So Ukrainians know that they have no choice but sort of to go along with it to a certain extent and to hope that, like in the past, they'll be able to change Trump's mind and present him with a more acceptable paper, which Trump would then back.
How significant do you think it is that European leaders did seem initially sidelined or frozen out of this process?
I think it's very telling and very characteristic to this whole process. Europe has been sidelined, and that's been one of Russia's main wishes, that they only talk to the Americans because they consider themselves a superpower alongside the Americans.
Right.
There are reports.
So Putin has no interest in talking to any other.
There's no interest,
leader.
And he really looks down on the Europeans. I think it's very telling that a lot of European officials only found out about this original plan from media reports. So they've been humiliated, I think that's fair to say, and have been scrambling to change the momentum.
And to exert some influence.
And I think it's very striking how left out they've been, because we're talking about European security here. Some of the terms directly included European interests, for example, the frozen assets. And Europe said, well, it's up to us to decide what happens to those assets, not up to Americans or Russians. Another term said that all the Western jets that were given to Ukraine, that they would be stationed in Poland. And the Polish president said, no decision about Poland can be made without our input. So I think it's telling, it's pretty baffling, frankly, that how sidelined Europe has been. I think Europe is obviously also very concerned that if Russia comes out of this on top, they're sort of next in this broader conflict between Russia and the West. Russia has over a million troops now stationed in and around of Ukraine. What happens to all those soldiers? Will sort of a confident Putin start looking to provoke things in the Baltics or in Moldova? So I think for Europe, it's very important to make sure that Russia doesn't come out of this war emboldened to go after Europe next. But Europe has its own sort of Trump whispers, and they're working overtime right now. One of them is Alexander Stubb, the head of Finland.
You know, when we speak among leaders,
who's sort of very friendly with Trump.
This call this morning was rather spontaneous. So
Meloni, the leader of Italy, is sort of on the line with Trump.
It was just a good opportunity for Prime Minister Meloni and myself to speak with the president this morning.
We're also seeing Keir Starmer calling Trump and Merz of Germany. So yeah, they're getting activated again. But we see that Zelensky is on the phone with them as well. So I think their main goal right now is to change Trump's mind and show that the original plan is just completely unreasonable, and hope that Trump would accept sort of this reworked plan that's been made on Sunday.
Trump, of course, is so very keen to present himself as the world's deal-making, war-ending hero-in-chief. How important is he to this calculation, to what Russia and Ukraine ultimately agree to?
Yeah, as you said, Trump's way of presenting himself is as a peacemaker. We never really know how many wars he solved, because it changes in his mind. Sometimes 8, sometimes 9. Of course, he's feeling confident after the Gaza ceasefire, even though that appears to be pretty shaky. But at the same time, I think it's very important for Trump to get a deal now, because his ratings at home are going down. He, of course, promised that he would solve this war in 24 hours.
I would get a settlement in 24 hours. Now, it should have never happened. You have thousands, hundreds of thousands.
Of course, this is initial yeah, promise coming into office.
He sort of quickly realized that it's much harder. So he needs a diplomatic victory, and I think he wants to focus more on domestic U.S. politics, on the economy that's not going well. But the question is, to what extent Trump really has any leverage over Russia? Of course, he can, with Ukraine, he can cut off weapons, can cut off intelligence. He seems to be able to pressure Zelensky. But with Russia, yes, he's introduced sanctions against major oil companies. But, you know, for Putin, this war is so existential that it's rather unlikely that, you know, Putin would give in much,
right,
just because Trump has threatened him.
Coming up, what will it take to get this deal over the line?